Tim here with a message before the podcast. Due to rights reasons, the songs have been shortened for this podcast. Every song is taken from B-52's Cosmic Thing. All tracks are written by the B-52s, Kate Pearson, Fred Schneider, Keith Strickland and Cindy Wilson, except for Rome, with lyrics by Robert Waldrop. Cosmic Thing was released on 27th of June 1989 on Reprise. Now, enjoy the podcast.
Tim's listening party was a lockdown sensation.
Unfortunately, it was on Twitter, which you can't listen to.
But Absolute Radio has the solution.
Tim Burgess explores seminal albums alongside the artists who brought them to life.
Absolute Radio presents Tim's Listening Party with Tim Burgess.
Hiya, and welcome to another episode of Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio. I'm Tim Burgess, and I'm excited to be sitting down with another band to play back a classic album together. If you've missed any episode of the show, Tis Affairs, Deacon Blue, Buzzcocks, OMD, Sparks, The Bangles, Fall Out Boy, The Kinks, you too, make sure to catch up by searching Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts. A huge part of the show is about getting involved on Twitter, so make sure to tweet your thoughts to @Tim_Burgess and @AbsoluteRadio. Using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party. This episode I'm joined by Kate Pearson and Keith Strickland from B-52s, a band so unique, so unorthodox, yet completely distinctive. It's not often that you get to say that a musical artist is completely original, as if from outer space. But it's very difficult to pigeonhole the B-52s, which is why I'm leaving it to some of their most famous fans. Boy George described them as punk space age irreverence, like a beautiful car crash with pop surrealism. Rock Lobster is the Beach Boys on crack. Bikini Kill's Kathleen Hanna highlighted their humour. She said, "Their music is so joyous and interesting and such a celebration of independent thinking." Jerry Castle of Devo said of the B-52s, "It was like they'd come from their own planet. Who on earth sings about a rock lobster?" They were transgressive and polarising. They were in a realm of LGBTQ music before such a thing was even identified. Thanks so much for helping me out here and doing a Cosmic Thing.
All right.
Talking about this classic record as a listening party.
Woo!
This is lovely to be here.
Yeah. And it's a party.
Yeah, it's a real thing for me. Being a longtime fan since, I don't know, 16 years old.
Oh, that makes us older then.
I'm certainly getting on a bit now.
No way. Stay 15, okay.
Well, I mean, you know, we're here to talk about Cosmic Thing, but I, you know, first heard Rock Lobster and Give Me Back My Man and, you know, Planet Claire when I first got a job, actually, in Manchester. My first job was delivering mail at an industrial chemical factory. And, you know, I would just idly pass the time by listening to music, and B-52s were prevalent on my headset. And I just want to thank you for that.
Thank you.
I spent some time in Newcastle and Manchester.
You did?
Yeah, I spent time in Newcastle. Let's just say that. I worked as a bartendress.
It's very cold up there.
It is cold, and it's beautiful, though. I love the north.
Yeah. It's I mean, I'm in London now, and I live in London, but yes, growing up in the north is a very different vibe, really, and different feeling, I was gonna say.
Yeah.
But I guess anyone who knows the band, you know, knows that you formed in Athens, Georgia.
Yes, that's where we were born.
So it's kind of like you met Ricky.
Well, I met Ricky in high school, and Cindy.
And then we're asked to play at a house party. Is that right? A house party? Yeah.
In fact, we just had an anniversary. I can't even count how many anymore. But Valentine's Day was our first gig. And it was a house party in Athens, Georgia. Just a little house.
Yeah.
And opposite the taco stand. And we had borrowed speakers and equipment. And literally the house shimmied because somebody had to hold the speakers and, you know, onto the bookshelves where they were. People were dancing. Our friends were dancing. So it was we knew we had something going when we first played that party.
Wow. What a thrill. I mean, how many songs did you have when you played that party?
Six or something.
Maybe six songs. Yeah. All of the songs were on the first album.
Yeah.
And Strobe Light was on the second album, I think.
Right.
Right, yeah. Right.
So it was pretty much our first album.
Yeah.
When I spoke to some friends of mine that I was going to be talking to today, they were saying, oh, every house party used to play that first B-52s album. And I thought, you know, that you created your sound for a house party, basically, and it still resonates in house parties all over the world.
Right.
Every generation, you know, since then. So I think it's a real achievement, and it really came from the source.
I mean, we thought of ourselves as a dance band. We love to dance. And Athens is just a, well, university town, but yeah. Still our group of friends just love to dance. And we would dance during the day or anytime. So we just sort of wanted to be, that was our, it was a natural thing that we would write music to dance to.
Yeah. And then you traveled to New York a lot and played a lot in New York. Is that right?
We forged a path there after.
There were friends of ours in Atlanta who had a band called The Fans, and they were playing clubs in New York. They started and they said, you guys should go up there. So we went.
Yeah.
We played Maxis, Kansas City, like on a Monday night in the middle of winter.
Nice.
And there were probably like 15 people in the audience at the most.
Right.
I don't know. And then we just packed up the car. We had, you know, driven up in a station wagon, and we immediately just packed up the car again, and we were heading back, and a friend of ours said, well, ask if they want you back, you know? And so we, somebody ran in and asked, and they said, yeah, come back. So we started playing. Yeah. So that's when we started commuting more or less from Athens to New York and playing the clubs.
Right.
CBGBs, we started, and it was always, you know, Max's and CB's were sort of competitive at one point.
Yeah.
And we would drive all the way from Athens. So we would try to get both gigs in. And they eventually allowed us to do it. You know, they didn't want us. If we were playing Max's, they wouldn't have us. But eventually the interest was growing.
Yeah.
And so we were able to get a gig at CB's.
And then we played Hurrahs, and we opened the Mud Club, this sort of famous club called the Mud Club. We were the first band to play there. And you know, we started expanding, and our audience started expanding. And one night we played Hurrahs.
Yeah.
And I remember Ricky looked out the window and said, oh, my God, so many people in line out there. What are they in line for? And they said, that's for us.
Wow.
And I realized then that we were, you know, we'd made it. You know, we were the talk of the town, I guess.
Wow. I mean, all of these clubs are sort of like, you know, places that I grew up, you know, dreaming about going to, you know. I mean, I managed to go to CBGBs, and pretty sure that Max's wasn't around when I first went to New York.
Speaking of clubs, Keith and I went to what was the club we went to in Manchester, the famous club?
Oh, the Hacienda.
Hacienda.
Yeah. Did you? Oh.
Yeah.
And we got there and we danced and danced and danced. And Keith and I were dancing, and then we didn't realize everyone was on ecstasy except us. And then all of a sudden it was 10:30 and the lights went up and everyone just ran to get the train, I guess. So we were like, what the hell? It's 10:30. It just shut down. It was maybe 11 o'clock or something. But anyway, it was fun.
The Hacienda is such a B-52's place.
Yeah, it was just great to have been there.
Yeah, I think it was like around 1992.
Yeah.
1992, I think.
Wow. I was probably there, actually. Oh, no, I think my band had just kicked off. But, you know, from like 87 to 89, I was there every weekend. Yeah. I was a dancer. Yeah.
That was such a great scene that you were a part of, though. I love that, all of that.
Yeah.
You know, your band and...
Oh, thanks, Keith. So amazing. Thank you.
Happy Mondays.
Happy Mondays, everybody. Yeah.
It was just really great.
New Order.
Yeah, definitely New Order.
I digress.
All right. So back to cosmic order of things.
Exactly. And what a perfect time to play the title track and kick off this listening party. This is the B-52s with Cosmic Thing. Bye. So the first track on the album is the title track. And would you say it was a comeback record?
We certainly didn't think of it when we were writing it. You know, this was right after Ricky had died.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, that was devastating. So we just kind of went our separate ways for about a year or maybe a little more. And then eventually I moved up to Woodstock, New York. And I was living in the city. And I was just living up there by myself. And I started writing some music, and then I played something that I was writing for Cindy and Kate.
Yeah.
And then we thought, we started warming up to the idea, well, maybe we can do something. But, you know, it was back to zero with that album, you know, and we weren't,
right.
I think our contract with the label had timed out, so we didn't have a contract.
Uh-huh.
We fired our manager, so we were just pretty much really starting from zero, you know.
Yeah.
And I started driving into the city and commuting to write with the rest of the band who were in the city with Kate, Fred, and Cindy. It just was like so great to be together, and we found a lot of comfort in being together. And so literally some of the writing sessions were just us sitting around talking, you know.
Yeah, we spent whole days, yeah.
Yeah, but it was, you know, it was therapeutic because it was
right.
Such a devastating loss, Ricky's death. And
right.
And so we just started writing just for ourselves, you know, and that, I think that shows. When I listen to Cosmic Thing now, I just feel like everything was coming from love. You know, it really was a lot of love right. in that album.
Yeah.
And we were feeling it.
It's an incredible record.
Yeah, we weren't writing for an audience. We weren't writing for another album, really. We were just writing, you know, we were just
right. exactly.
doing what we like to do together. And it was such a great feeling.
Yeah, I think the whole concept when we got together was this was sort of bringing Ricky's spirit back in, and it was healing, as Keith said. It was just really healing for ourselves, and we sort of made a statement amongst ourselves that this was for us. We didn't care about having a hit. This was all going to be, you know, writing whatever we felt like, because we felt like Keith said, you know, we're starting from the ground zero, so we'd had nothing to lose. We just wanted to write,
and it's kind of like the way we started. You know, it was like in the beginning.
Yeah.
We really weren't even writing for our friends. We were just writing for ourselves because
yeah.
we just, there was really nothing else for us to do in Athens.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was like something to do, you know?
Yeah.
And it just popped out, you know, it all came out the way it did. And we didn't really try to tailor our sound or do anything. It happened
yeah.
spontaneously, you know?
Exactly.
It was all improv.
I mean, I do love the title track and, you know, the way it comes in. I'm sure, you know, for the listener at that time, it was like, and here they are, they're back. You know, it's like, you know, Fred starts off and it's kind of trademark, sort of like fun lyrics about honey buns and, you know, out of body experiences and stuff like that. And it's just, I don't know, it's a very reassuring opener. I'm pretty obsessed with openers and closers of albums. And did you always know that Cosmic Thing was going to be the opener to Cosmic Thing?
Keith did the track list.
No, actually, we sequenced the album with Niall uh-huh. Rogers, who was one of the yeah. producers. And we sequenced it. And I went back to the hotel room and I was listening to it. The first track was originally Love Shack because, you know, everybody felt, well, that's the strongest song, right? But I felt like every song was great on this album.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I thought, well, let's not give that away too soon. But then I started listening to it, and I spent the whole night with a cassette player and trying to sequence it with one cassette player. I don't know how I did that, actually. But and so I resequenced the whole album, and we were mastering it the very next day. And I called Niall and I said, look, we're going to resequence this. And he was like, oh, no. You know, he was dreading it, but he listened to it and he thought, okay, it works, you know.
Right, right.
But yeah, it didn't, wasn't originally going to be, Cosmic Thing was not going to be the starter. But it felt like to me, like, where else can you put that? It's just such a statement, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just kicks it all off.
It comes out with a bang. And I love the line that comes out, Fred sings, don't let it rest on the president's desk, rock the house. You know, it's got, besides the honey buns, it's got some political inferences in there. So
yeah.
I thought
yeah.
it was just, it's very, it's current.
It's everything, isn't it, really? It's everything that you'd want from brand new B-52's track, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the whole album just, the sequence kind of, there's an arc to it.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of, yeah. I always felt like the title track was sort of like, I kind of saw it like a movie,
yeah.
you know, so the title track just kicks it off, kind of says what the whole thing is about, really. It's all a cosmic thing.
Yeah.
And then it goes into Dry County, is the landscape, right?
Right?
You know, that's the setting, you know, and then it goes from there into the future.
Well, before we talk about it, let's hear Dry County by the B-52s, track 2 on Cosmic Thing. When the blues County is like just my favorite.
Right.
You know, I hate to say it's my favorite because we're so early into the album, but I mean, that's such a bliss song. My second favorite is the one that comes after it as well. But we'll get onto that in a second. I mean, Dry County, I first heard about Dry Counties when I went to visit a friend in Dallas. But this, people who don't know, it's like a place that you can't buy alcohol. Oh, it's illegal, which begs the question then, you know, it's like, so how do people find a way to get alcohol then?
But moonshine.
Exactly.
Is there such a thing as a dry county in England?
No, there isn't.
No, and such a bad idea.
And if there was, you know, people would find a way to find what they need.
People did.
Yeah. But to me, dry county, it's that other meaning, you know, where it just feels like it's just a landscape. It's just a beautiful thought. And the song is incredible. I mean, I love the lyrics. Kate, do you want to talk me through the lyrics? Because I think you sing a lot of them.
Well, I just love that line, "Here come the girls up the road. What they want to do, they can't do.
Here come the girls
up the road.
What they want to do, they can't do. Cause it's a
drive."
And that just says so much about America and teenagers. And, you know, during that time, it just seemed like, you know, it hasn't to do with alcohol, but just, you know, that kind of teenage angst, even though we were not teenagers, but we kind of always felt that living in Athens, there was just nothing. Like Keith said, we made the band because we had nothing to do.
Yeah.
And we had plenty to drink and plenty to smoke. But, but you know, there were only house parties. And Athens in the summer is very, very hot. And it's red earth. And it just really conjures up that feeling, you know, of it's a dry county. There's nothing to do. And I love the lyrics of that. And
it's
just like, it is very cinematic. It should be in a movie. I don't know if it was ever used in a movie.
I don't think so.
I mean, it's definitely its own movie. It's definitely its own movie. I love the lines. "Blues kicks you in the head when you roll out of bed in the morning. Sit on the porch and swing.
Sit in the porch and swing." Because that, in Athens too, there were all these old houses. And I lived in this old tenant farmer's house out in the country.
Yeah.
And it had this iconic, you know, just kind of like was in the color purple, that kind of house. It had a porch and it had a hammock on the porch. And that's what people did when it was hot. They didn't have air conditioning. So they would sit on the porch and just outside and in the shade under the porch. And you'd see people, you'd drive out in the country and it was hot. You just see people sitting out there, or maybe a chair under a tree, you know. So it was so, so Southern, really, that kind of picture.
Yeah. I've never been to Athens, but, you know, I've spent quite a bit of time in Atlanta. And I think I know the kind of houses that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And
like a shack,
very beautiful.
Basically. Love shack.
Yeah. Like a shack. But it's not about me. But, I mean, I used to like going to restaurants that were kind of like they would have about three tables and they were just like in houses, and there seems to be quite a lot of those there.
Yeah, used to be. I don't know, not much anymore, I don't think.
Oh, maybe not. This was the 90s.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to the song. I mean, it's a beauty. I mean, what's the chord sequences, Keith? I was trying to work it out on the guitar one.
So, I really don't know.
But I think it was pretty simple, but there's like so much melody over the guitar.
Yeah.
It's just.
Yeah. I think on that one, I kind of started it with a bass line and the keyboard riff. That sort of.
What's so interesting to me about that song is that, like many of our songs, we write collectively, so we jam. And Keith had all the music done, but we were jamming on the lyrics and the melodies and the harmonies and all. And a lot of that just is spontaneous, but we would record all the parts and then put the parts together, the best parts.
Yeah.
And the chorus sort of doesn't happen till the very end. There's just a series of parts and then, you know, some repeat, but at the end it's the dry county.
Yeah.
It's sort of the kicker.
Yeah.
And it's just comes at the end.
I love how you and Cindy sort of like stretch out all the lines, you know, with the dry.
Yeah.
It just sort of came through jamming.
Yeah.
So it's not thought out.
Yeah.
Just like the band was not really thought out. It's just not, oh, let's, you know, try to fill it this way or do this kind of interval harmony. It's just flowed with the jam, whatever came out.
All right, let's move on to track number three on Cosmic Thing. It's Deadbeat Club. Keith, tell me about that last track, Deadbeat Club.
That was actually probably the first song I completed when I was in Woodstock. And I just wrote that for myself, really. And the funny thing is I, not really funny thing, could be kind of poignant, I guess. Yeah. I was imagining Ricky, because that album, I was just continuing doing what I had been doing when Ricky and I would write together.
Yeah.
A lot of times when he and I would write, I would kind of structure a song, maybe it would only be the chorus and a verse. We wouldn't have a bridge. We always had trouble finding a bridge. But and I would play it for Ricky, and so I kind of would structure it, and I would play it for Ricky, and he would say if it sucks or not, you know. But otherwise, when I was writing by myself after Ricky had died, I was imagining him sitting across from me.
Yeah.
And playing.
Wow.
And it was just, it was a kind of self, a way to be self-consoling, you know, because it was a grieving process for me. And so that song was, as I was writing it, the music, I was thinking a lot about Athens and our lives together, the band and Ricky. And so when I played the song, the backing track for Kate, Fred, and Cindy, and they started jamming on it, I didn't say anything about that. I didn't say what I was thinking when I wrote it and then the music. And then they immediately started. I don't know how, Kate, do you remember how soon you clicked in onto the, because it's the most autobiographical song I think we've ever written.
One thing I remember very strongly, and like you say, sometimes memory is part imagination, but I do remember this very strongly, that most of Deadbeat Club came out of the very first jam.
Yeah.
And sometimes we would jam on a song, and we jammed during the early days. We used cassette player, and then we would record things on a cassette player and then make a library, like an edit, onto the double cassette player, onto the next cassette. And then we would try to learn those parts. And sometimes we make a third edit with another tape. But this time we worked in the studio with an engineer who had, did he have Pro Tools? Yeah, it was Pro Tools.
You were still putting your vocals on cassette.
When we were writing in the studio?
Yeah, for Cosmic. Yeah.
Downtown?
Yeah. I would come in with a cassette and I would play the cassette. And then you guys would jam and you were putting it on, on another cassette player.
But it came out of the very first session.
Yeah.
So most of the lyrics and everything came out of the very first session of jamming. So I thought that was kind of amazing because it really came out and we didn't have the concept. We didn't hear what Keith said about conjuring Ricky, but it really is all about early Athens and Ricky, and it's all very autobiographical because we really did that. We hung out, drank coffee and talked and talked and talked about what we're going to do. And we made plans and, you know, it's sort of connected to Dry County in a lot of ways. You know, it's just hanging out in Athens and thinking about your, you know, what you're going to do. You have the future ahead of you and you've just started a band. And, you know, by this time we were restarting, rebooting, I guess. And the fact that Ricky was gone made it just so like, can we do it? Can we do it?
Yeah.
And I think, Keith, you played me that track because I had a house, a little cabin in Woodstock across the pond from where Keith lived. And I'd row my canoe over there. And Keith played me a couple of things early on that you were working on. And that's when we sort of thought, oh, this is really exciting. You know, you're writing some great stuff and it was inspiring.
I really like the mention of 96 Tears in the lyrics.
Yeah.
Going down to Allen's for a 25-cent beer. And the jukebox playing real love. 96 Tears.
And that, Allen's was, Allen's, that's yeah. all true too. There was 25 cent beer at this place called Allen's. It doesn't exist anymore, but it had a jukebox with 96 Tears on it. So it just sort of fit in there.
Everything in that song is true.
Yeah.
Or happened.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, it really happened.
Yeah.
Dancing in the garden in torn sheets in the rain.
We did that too. And that was kind of inspired by a friend, Jeremy. And we'd have these sort of avant-garde parties where one time we had a going away party for a friend of ours and it was silent. So we would dance in silence, you know, like, but we did, Jeremy inspired us when it was pouring rain and it was so hot that we would just take a sheet or whatever, you know, and just go out in the rain and just wrap ourselves and like dance in the rain. So that's true as well.
So good. Such a good image.
Yeah.
Next up, we have a song that maybe a lot of people are not that familiar with. Love Shack.
Oh, that one.
Before we talk about this classic, let's hear it. That was track 4 from Cosmic Thing, Love Shack.
I mean, it really transcended
yes.
everything, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That one that one almost, well, I say it, that it almost didn't make it, but it there was no way it was not going to make it on the album. But it was the least finished song when we went into the studio with Don Was.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it didn't have the chorus yet. Yeah. I mean, that part was in the song, but only occurred once.
And Fred and I had a little bit of a dispute about that. And I said, it should recur. But he was, you know, I mean, but most of our songs were kind of a string of parts. So he was like, it happens once. And I did whisper when we went to the studio with Niall, because we did rehearsal with Niall. So we were at this little church recording studio. It's in a old church called Dreamland. And we rehearsed with Don Was. And so I said to Don, maybe that chorus, it's like, to me, that's the chorus. And then he suggested it. And that was just the missing piece. All the elements were there. Yeah. But when we just put that there, it brought it together. It was like, it's the chorus, really, with Love Shack, you know, that and Love Shack.
Yeah.
It's just, it made it bond together. And it was it. That was it.
When you finished the song in the studio, could you tell that it was going to be a big song?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I remember we recorded basically, this is how I remember, you may want to correct me on this, Kate, but when we were in the studio recording it, I think we got the rhythm track down, and then you and Cindy and Fred were recording your vocals. I mean, you'd already done a guide, already recorded a guide vocal, but then you were, you know, finishing it up, you know, like
right.
getting it really down the way you wanted. And I remember you were doing a really great take, and I may have been playing a second guitar or something too. I'm not sure, but I think we already had the rhythm track down and we were in the middle of this really great take and the whole, like all the electricity went out because there was an electrical storm.
Oh yeah. I remember that. Yes. Yes.
And we were like, no, not now, you know? And so then we went, we took a break and went to go eat and we came back and we listened to it and it was like, phenomenal. I mean, we loved it.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And so we immediately just, because we only had just a little bit more to do vocally.
Yeah.
And you guys went in and finished it up. And then we did one edit. We just put that, tagged it onto the first bit. And the edit is right where the sort of bass breakdown is. So it kind of worked out seamlessly. But yeah, that song has, it just had such spirit, like from the very beginning.
Yeah.
It really, wow. I mean, I feel like two things at least. I mean, it's interesting because we had never done a sort of a more R&B type groove like that.
Right.
That was the first time we had really tried that.
Yeah.
I just felt in the mood of doing that. And so Charlie Drayton was the drummer on that track.
Right.
And his kickoff, I mean, his groove on that song is just phenomenal. And it just laid just such a nice bed for the rest of it to blossom, yeah. You know. And then I think the lyrics you guys wrote and your melodies and the vocals and the spirit in which you sang it just popped like nothing I'd heard before from you guys. I mean, you know, it was really something.
Yeah. It was the perfect blend of the Fred and Kate and Cindy thing, you know, because it was a story and like Fred's sort of, we're all telling parts of the story and it was just so balanced and had the harmonies. And like, I think the real thing though was that groove, you know, the groove really made it be the hit it is, I think. And I just remember though, Charlie Drayton, back in those days, we'd play the drums over and over and over until you got, and then, you know, oh, that's, and then you'd be, that's it. That's the take. You know, it seems like nowadays you just like, I don't know. It just seems so much quicker. I don't know why. And I remember we, at some point we played that for REM.
Yeah.
We played Love Shack, but yeah. REM was in the studio at the same time. And they, or they came to see us and they heard it and they were like, "Hey, that's a hit. That's a hit." And then, you know, once they blessed it, yeah. You know, I think we knew even more, but we had no idea what was going to happen. No. I mean, we thought it was good, but
no, to me, it's one of those songs where the music and the lyric really match up.
Yeah.
Because the music sounds like what's happening, what you're singing about really, you know, it really captures this whole thing. But going back to, I felt like this album, A Cosmic Thing, was just really coming from a place of love.
Yeah.
There's no greater embodiment of that on this album than that one. You know, it really sounds like that.
Yeah. And I think the video, which was turned out to be a party. RuPaul was there and Lady Bunny and all our friends and came up to upstate New York at our friend's house. And that was their actual house with the goats and the checkerboard roof and everything. And that's where they lived. So the video turned into kind of a party too. And it was fun.
Yeah, it's a great video. I love that song. So that's another true story.
Yep.
What was kind of like, wasn't the lyric partly on about a club in Athens?
Well, there's a whole history of the Hawaiian Hali, and I looked it up, and there's a whole history about it. And our friend Calvin, his parents used to go there, and it was conceived as this, you know, integrated. It was African-American guy opened it, but he wanted it to be integrated and have the music. Anyway, Calvin sent me a picture of his parents dancing there, and it was just like, there's a whole history about it. But for me, I lived in this little shack out in the country. And the line that I have set way back in the middle of a field, just a funky old shack, is sort of directly about my house because it was in the middle of a field. And we would go out there and we did some writing there. We did Private Idaho, I think we wrote or finessed out at my cabin there.
Mm-hmm.
$15 a month.
Wow. That's a good time. Yeah. I mean, it's very rare to get a song like that. I mean,
yeah.
You know, when it all just comes together, it's a beautiful feeling, right?
Yeah, you don't know when it's going to happen. You don't know how it happens. And when it does, it's like pretty magical.
Yeah. I mean, to have a song like that, that everyone knows, I mean, even if they don't know the B-52s, and then you say Love Shack, their faces light up. So,
yeah. It's an amazing thing.
That song is more famous than we are.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I'd take that. You
which
know,
is fine
I mean,
with me.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah. That's yeah. what I meant.
Fine
yeah.
with me.
Exactly.
Okay, let's hit the next track. The last track on side one, Junebug. That wall of vengeance. Junebug by B-52s. What can you tell me about that one, Keith?
That's another kind of autobiographical thing.
Yeah.
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 Well, it's kind of like that's what we would do the next day after a party. So Love Shack, the party, you know, and then the next morning or next day, you just kind of chill, go to the rivers, hang out.
Yeah.
And
swim.
Yeah. It's kind of.
And that's another true story that we would go down the Oconee River, which is a muddy river outside of Athens. And we would go tubing yeah. which featured greatly in this song about tubing.
yeah.
And you would sit in the in an inner tube, big inner tube, yeah. hopefully like a truck inner tube or something, and you'd all hook together, and at the end, you would have an inner tube filled with beer. So you would just go very slowly, because it was a very slow river. You'd go slowly down there and drink beer and just float in your inner tube. So that was sort of the concept. And Fred came up, I think, with the sort of character of Junebug in a way, as this sort of personification, the wild thing.
That was the first song we did write together when we started writing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It was Junebug. It was actually the first piece of music I started to write. I didn't really finish it because when I moved to Woodstock, I was living on a pond. And I hadn't started writing again really yet, but I was recording. So in the pond, it was full of wildlife. And so the sounds were amazing.
Big snapping turtles.
I used to go out and record the sounds because I was just fascinated by them. So I'd sit with my headphones and with these microphones and I would record these sounds. And so I had that and I laid it down as I was playing around with it and I just started playing music over it. So it was kind of this nature mm-hmm. ambient
right.
background that sort of inspired the rest of it.
Snakes and snappers and alligators and razorbacks. We have all these like animals in the lyrics. And I think Fred's obsessed with razorback hogs. And we've always tried to write a song about razorbacks because there are these kind of wild feral hogs that are in some of the sea islands of Georgia. And anyway, they're very aggressive. So Fred was always like, kind of obsessed with. So we have razorbacks in there and alligators and snakes and snappers. And there were big snapping turtles in that pond because I lived across the pond and I'd see these huge snapping turtles. So it was a nature reserve.
Yeah, it sounds like a zoo.
Yeah.
Let's move to side two of the album, Rome. Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing you at Benny Kassim 2007.
Right, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that song was, you know, the song of the festival for me. So please explain how you wrote it.
I would say, though, it's interesting because when I was sequencing, I felt like the whole first of the album is sort of like us in Athens, right? You know, in our life in Athens, kind of what we did there. Uh-huh. But then the side two, when you could have a side two, it departs. Yeah. And Rome is where we start to move out of that, you know. So, Kate, you can finish with the lyrics.
Goes into a cosmic arena. Well, our friend Robert Waldrop, who had also written lyrics for us for Dirty Back Road and Girl from Ipanema Goes to Greenland and yeah. Deep Sleep. And yeah. anyway, he had sent these lyrics to Keith and to me, and I had them, and he wrote them out in this big piece of paper. And I just thought Keith had this beautiful music, and it was so evocative and just like I thought these lyrics. So I just took them out and because usually we sometimes would be like, okay, titles, you know, when we jam, if you have a title idea, that's a good starter.
Yeah.
But anyway, this was a whole lyric. This isn't the only song I think we've ever done that really had, you know, it really had it laid out like a verse, chorus, you know, so it was very kind of easy. And Keith's music, it just fit right in with that. So Cindy and I the harmonies just came naturally. We just did the harmonies. And sometimes Cindy had the high and I had the low, and then we would jam and switch.
Yeah.
And we did it just like that. We tried to recreate the jam, you know, so we did it. I think when we recorded it, we did it kind of just like that, where we kind of switched around a little bit. But the harmony just came as a jam.
And again, the video was amazing as well, isn't it?
The video was really cool. Yeah, I love the video. And we did that one with Niall. And it's interesting because mm-hmm. each of them, since neither of them had the time to do the whole album, we wound up with two producers. Yeah. And we're like, that's going to be weird. Yeah. But it turned out to be really great. And they were very different in their approach because Niall was much more production. And he had opinions. And Don was like, part of the band, you know. Well, they were both part of the band, but Don was much more like, let's just see how it goes, let's rehearse it and feel it out. And he was a more organic approach, I guess. But it's interesting that they both picked one of the hits by just sort of, you know, they had a choice of which songs they would do. And
Don picked Love Shack.
Right. And Niall picked Rome. Right. Yeah. You know, it was interesting that they both had a hit, basically.
Going back to their styles, I think Don was looking for the feel to come out of the performance. That was it. If the band, we rehearsed before going into the studio with Don. He wanted to get the band to really have a vibe, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what I think he was looking for.
Right.
Where Niall is a little bit more, we can do little things to make it work.
Yeah. You know?
But he would want a good feel too, you know? But he had a little more tricks, vocal tricks and little things that he would do that were really interesting.
I mean, first, were they both like first choices? Did you know that you wanted Don or Niall to produce it? And you know, were you huge fans of the stuff that they'd done before?
We hadn't met Don, but we knew of Niall.
We did Cosmic Thing with Niall first, and it was a song that was for a movie, right? Earth Girls Are Easy. So we did that prior to recording the album. And so we had worked with him on that, and that went really well. Uh-huh. But I knew Chic. I love Chic, mm-hmm. and I knew Niall's work from that, but I wasn't that familiar with Don.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a psychic involved, which is a long story, but to cut to the chase, a friend of mine's mother was a psychic.
Yeah.
The psychic kind of reviewed, she had no idea what music or anything about music industry. And I read her the list of producers because we did meet with some other ones. So I list about 10 producers, and she said, "Oh my God, the spirit guides love Niall." And that just confirmed it, I guess. And she said they loved Don too. So I guess that just put an extra icing on the cake. But basically we met with Don and he had sunglasses on. So we were a little bit like, he never took them off. And we were a little bit like, who's this dude? He wouldn't take his glasses off, but we liked him a lot. And we liked Was Not Was, but it turned out he had some kind of eye infection or something. But anyway, he was very warm and just engaging. And Niall is so personable and really fun in the studio, always making everyone laugh. And you have to kind of be a psychologist too. And when you're a producer, you know, you have to make sure everyone's happy. Yeah. And so they were both really good at that, making us feel comfortable.
That's good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've met them both. They're both lovely.
He's a great storyteller.
Niall.
Gosh. Yeah. He's got great stories.
I kind of hosted an event and he was interviewed at a place that I have called Tim Peaks. And, it was very lovely. And I met Don in, it was a John Fogerty party, of all places in San Diego.
Anyway, enough of that. Let's hear the song we've been talking about. Here's Rome on Absolute Radio. Track number 6 on Cosmic Thing, Rome.
So you've always jammed, right? I mean, from the beginning. Yeah. And I mean, do you rehearse a lot? Do you enjoy the rehearsal process?
Yeah, I think we rehearsed a lot.
Yeah?
Especially in the beginning when we went to New York and we go back, Ricky was kind of the taskmaster and he would have us rehearse and rehearse and rehearse and we'd write a new song or two and then be able to go back to New York with maybe 8 songs, you know, so... I think we are a band that likes to rehearse and gel.
I mean, when you and Cindy sing, it seems so formed, you know, like I'm the worst rehearser in the world. so I try to skip it at all costs. But I see the value, you know.
Well, it's really good when you have played the songs live and then you could record them, which is the case with the first two albums mostly.
Yeah.
We had already played those songs. And so recording them, and when we recorded the first album, you know, it was just very live-ish, live kind of raw. But Cosmic Thing was much more.
It was live. Yeah. The first album was live in the studio, except for Ricky, I think, had one or two guitar overdubs as a second guitar part. But yeah, the rest of it was done live in the studio.
And that was it. Was it Nassau, was it?
In Nassau, yeah. In the Bahamas, yeah.
In the Bahamas. So, I mean, how did it feel then, you know, from sort of like forming a band and a house party and then, you know, making your way to New York and then all of a sudden ending up in the Bahamas?
It was like a dream. We just took off. All of a sudden we were there.
It was like going on vacation and making your album.
I suppose you made it quite quickly though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty quickly. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just exactly like we sound on stage. We were disappointed, sort of.
Well,
sort of. Anyway.
It didn't sound
a little better.
Yeah, I don't know. It didn't to me. I remember hearing it after we mixed it, and I was like, this sounds horrible.
Oh, no.
Because it didn't, to me, it didn't sound like the way we sounded on stage. Because, you know, you're in a small club, and it's really echoey, and everything's yeah. just like, all the sound is meshing together. And it's, and this was very, to me, it sounded very clinical. You know, it was very, it almost sterile.
Wow. You know?
In retrospect, I think it was great.
Yeah.
It's a good document.
Yeah.
But, I felt like we sounded much more splashy and a little sassier.
I mean, it captured the sparseness and the weirdness, I think, of how we,
yeah,
you know, we may have thought we sounded one way on stage, but I think actually, you know, just we all played whatever we played on stage, and we, I just captured that kind of essence, I think, that we're so sparse.
Yeah, I remember with my band, we'd rehearse in the early days, and I'd hear everything, and then when we'd play live, I wouldn't be able to hear anything, you know. So when we came to record our first album, I was surprised about how many harmonies there was backing vocals, because I could never really hear them on stage, and it's like, oh well, we've got really good backing vocals, so yeah. And so I was pleased about that. But yeah, generally if it doesn't sound like you sound on stage, that's all you do at the beginning. It's a shock, isn't it, you know?
Right
So you follow Rome on the record with Bushfire.
Oh, yeah. Bushfire.
Bushfire is the oddball for me.
Yeah, yeah. Where did that come from?
and when I was sequencing, I went, I don't know where to put this one. You know, I mean, but you know, it had to, it was a good spot. It worked.
Yeah, it's a good spot.
But it kind of works too. You think of it, well, okay, we're leaving. So Rome is kind of a departure, yeah. Rome, if you want to, Rome. And then it goes into Bushfire. So you're kind of going into this dark night of the soul, so to speak, or you're going into unknown, the dark mystery of the forest. You know, you don't know where you're going.
Yeah.
And it kind of, the song doesn't really say that, but it has that feeling to me.
I mean, the mystery is the best place.
Is it? Because it kind of plays around. There's some, it's kind of like you feel there's a sense of danger in there. I don't know, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Or trepidation, maybe.
It's kind of one of our disaster songs. Yeah, we have a lot of disaster
Bushfire.
Songs, like volcanoes and fires and
bushfires.
You know, just razorbacks.
Nice.
And as usual, there's always like a sexual metaphor there somehow. Ever you want to read into that song. But it's also one of those cinematic sort of evocative of dry, you know, sort of country. And yeah,
what's the like preparation of going into doing a vocal?
warm up, you know, just to do a lot of vocal warm-ups. I think only the first two albums did we sort of play the songs before we recorded them, so all these songs we had, and we never played them live, so it would have really helped to go out and play them. Because it's so much easier. Sometimes a vocal part will be a little bit difficult. And then once you've been on the road with it, it's like, why did I even find that hard? You know, it's so easy to sing once you've sung it a few times and get it into your body. It's just warming up is the most important thing. And sing, as our vocal teacher once said, sing from the pussy. That's what he said. Yeah. We had this old geezer guy that Fred and Cindy and I went to, and that's good advice, yeah. But you know, singing from the diaphragm basically is the key there. So.
Do you sing separately, or do you do it together, or both?
We usually sing together with a, you know, they'll put a divider so the vocals don't
bleed.
Oh wow,
that's great, yeah.
Or sometimes we've been in a vocal booth, you know, just separate booths. But we always try to record it at the same time.
Yeah.
And then we do overdubs, you know, or then we do refine it. Sometimes we'll go in and do individual vocals. I mean, we've done it both all different ways, but initially we try to do it all at once, and we get the track, especially when we're tracking, then we'd all be singing too. So that was a good way to kind of warm up and rehearse songs too.
It'd be the most natural way of getting it down as well, I suppose. I mean,
yeah. So while they're doing drums and everything, we would be singing. So that would get everyone gelled a little bit.
Amazing. That's when the magic happens.
yeah, exactly.
Let's play Bushfire by the B-52s. Yeah. B-52's Bushfire. The next song is Channel Z, which was the first single, right?
That was a record company choice to put that out as the first single, I believe, because they wanted like a teaser.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And we'd been absent for so long, you know, after, you know, a few years. And so I guess it was good to put something out like we're here, we're back.
Good idea, do you think?
I liked it, but it was a departure, I think, from sort of the way we were perceived mostly, you know, like being sort of like more absurd. And I mean, I guess Channel Z has its fair share of absurdity.
Yeah. But it's much more political. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like space junk. And
yeah. We're getting into environmental themes. And
it's all about environmental disaster. Yeah. Another disaster song. And that was, I think the lyrics are very Fred-driven because Fred's singing all the negative things, you know, all the space junk and falling from the sky. And then Cindy and I are singing like, you know, let's all make it better and things will turn out better. So, yeah, there's a big countering kind of counterpoint there with something big and lovely.
Was it early in the writing? You know, did it come early or later? Or
it was sort of, no, it was sort of midpoint, I think, in the writing process.
Right?
Yeah, it was pretty well deep in there.
The line, you know, we have get nothing but static from Channel Z. So the only misstep in all this was all the radio stations with Z in their call name didn't play it. It's like, because it was sent, perceived as being negative to Z. So WZZ, whatever, Y station wouldn't play it. I mean, is that stupid or what? But anyway, I guess they got over it after a while.
They're very sensitive.
Yeah. I mean,
they're so sensitive. It's radio stations.
Oh, it's really, you know, it's nothing about the radio station. But the video was fun because we did it upstate.
The video is great, yeah.
I was running in high heels through the woods, you know, at Cooper Lake, around Cooper Lake here. And I remember we went way, way into the woods to this place, to this, you know, the rock and the waterfall. And we all had our outfits on.
It was all Woodstock, right?
Yeah, it was all done. Part of it was at the stage on CBGB's or something, I think.
Yeah, it was CB's and then Woodstock. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So what was the overall feeling then of, like, you know, making the record? You know, was there trepidation or was there like determination, or did you feel like you were being guided, you know, by Ricky, or, you know, or how did it feel? I mean, I'd like to share an experience of mine, which was our drummer passed away before we tried to make an album in 2013, and he had a brain tumor, and we were making the record and just nothing really was happening. Right. We wanted to keep going though, just to, you know, just keep your spirits up. And then when he died, we did this big celebration of his life, you know, at the Royal Albert Hall. And then we started making the record, and it's a very strange but very comforting feeling that we felt that he was, you know, he was with us. He wasn't in the same room, but he was there, maybe more present in lots of ways.
Yeah.
And it really helped us to make what we felt was like one of the best records of our career. So all the stuff that you've been saying about the making of this record has really resonated with me. I mean, obviously different circumstances and, you know, everyone's emotions are different and feelings and stuff like that. But I really get it, you know.
But you had the same kind of experience.
Yeah. And did you feel, I mean, how was the feeling? I mean, you talk about it all the time. And anyway, enough about me. But
well, I'm glad you shared that.
Well, no, your story resonates because I feel like that's exactly what we were going through too when we were working on it. Because, you know, when we started writing together, it was so great to be together, you know. And there was, like I said, there was a lot of love among us. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, Ricky's absence, but there was a presence there too, you know. He was gone, he wasn't there, but yet he was. And the amazing thing to me about that album was just how it just flowed so naturally. Everything. Our writing, we worked really well together.
Yeah.
We took our time, which was good. But our writing, we worked really well together. We were getting along really well. And everything just fell into place, you know, so naturally.
Yeah.
And that to me was, when I look back on it, I go like, wow, it's amazing how it just kind of flowed effortlessly. And I remember I felt very confident about what we had, about the material. Yeah. And I think we all did. I think we all felt equally confident and like we have something here. We know what we're, we know where we're going, yeah. Right? And then Niall and Don were great at helping us bring this to fruition, you know? It was really something.
Amazing work.
Well, let's hear the next song on Cosmic Thing, Channel Z.
So many things I hear in your music, and you know, I mean, I was going to mention Joe Meek. I don't know whether you're familiar with Joe Meek, and
yes,
oh, definitely.
I mentioned it for many reasons, but one of the reasons is that I want to get Joe Meek played on the radio. So I'm glad you agree.
Yes.
I would say Joe Meek was a huge influence on me because I was probably 8 or 9, and I had this little transistor radio, and I would listen to it. And I lived in the country in Georgia, and I would listen to this radio, and it was a station that came out of Chicago. It was an AM station, and it would sort of drift in and out, you know, phase shifting in and out because it was a bad reception. And I heard Telstar for the first time.
Wow.
And
wow.
It had that, I don't know, you know, the intro to Telstar, you know, with the space sounds and all.
Yeah.
And I remember hearing that, but it was like a combination of the radio shifting in and out and that sound. And then I really felt like I was hearing something coming from outer space. I guess literally I was.
Yeah.
And then my brother, who's older, bought the album, the Tornadoes' first album, at least the one that was released in America. And it just blew me away, you know. And I can hear the influence when I was writing the music for Planet Claire. That is direct influence from Telstar to the whole Joe Meek sound, and you know, and it was a big influence on me.
All recorded in a flat in Holloway, just up the road from here. So,
wow,
right.
That's very exciting. Yeah. There's so many brilliant records. I mean, the Tornadoes one is fantastic. I mean, there's a great compilation called "I Hear a New World," which
I love that.
Really, it's such a what's not to love about that.
Yep.
Great time.
But how was this album to play live?
Well, I think an interesting thing that happened. When we played live, I think Cindy, and I think you experienced this too, we all did, but particularly Cindy, felt like she looked over on the side of the stage and saw Ricky.
Yeah.
You know, she just felt like he was there when we played live. She would be like, oh, you know. So there was a feeling of his guiding presence in some ways, you know, because so many of the songs conjure that time in Athens. But I do think the planets, you know, being in a band, sort of the stars have to align for you to be all in the same place, for you to write together. And it's such a collaborative effort that it was just kind of magic, you know, because we don't always get along perfectly, but most of the time we do. We're still friends, which is amazing. And we still have a thread of a text that we do every day. Fred puts something crazy on there. We just put... Keith posts music and videos, and we just have a whole, you know, it includes the whole touring band because they're part of the band too. They've been with us so long. So, and that's another thing that we did with Cosmic Thing. We expanded the band beyond just the four of us. So that changed our sound, and we were able to play the songs because, the songs were much bigger and much more instrumentation and, a real bass. I mean, I played keyboard bass, but you know, this had like bass
guitar.
Yeah.
Well, live was another whole beast.
Oh yeah.
For me anyway. Yeah. Well, because I moved from playing drums live to, I had always played guitar in the studio and writing. But playing guitar live was another whole thing. I was just like, I was playing right on the edge of my limitation. I was like, and ironically, I didn't feel comfortable really playing live until about the year I decided to stop touring. So I finally got to this place where I was like, really, like, okay, now it feels, it has a nice fluid feel to it, and I'm pretty confident. And then I was like, but I don't want to tour anymore. So
Like, spoken like a true punk rocker.
I mean, it's amazing, though, that you came from being the drummer to, you know, playing the lead guitar. I mean, it was pretty amazing that you did that, and you did it so well. Yeah. And you also were able to incorporate Ricky's style, and you made your own style.
Well, yeah. So I felt good because we knew we were going out to tour on Cosmic Thing. Yeah. And those songs I had written myself, but then I had to learn Ricky's stuff. So I was like, but I was really familiar with his basic, you know, the way he tuned the guitars and his style of playing and his sensibility. I felt a real kinship to that. And at the time, you know, if we thought, well, we're going to get another guitarist, most guitarists would just sort of scoff at the idea of using open tunings. And I had used open tunings as well, so it was not an alien thing for me. So I felt like, well, I'll just do it, you know. But once I started learning Ricky's guitar parts, I realized I'm not going to be able to play with that finesse that he had. He just had this touch, right? So I just said, well, I'm just going to have to make it my own, right?
Yeah.
You know, he says, all you can do, really. You know, I didn't want to imitate him, but I wanted to remain true to his intent, I guess.
I mean, even though when we played live, we did Cosmic Thing, but we had to play Rock Lobster and we had to play, you know, Planet Claire, and like you had to play Ricky's parts that he created, and you worked with him on a lot of those, like you said. But I mean, he had these open tunings and strings missing, so it involved a lot of different guitars. So you had guitars with the middle string missing, right, for Rock Lobster. I think there were four strings on Rock Lobster, so there were two strings missing. And so anyway, it's just you had to learn that and work with all these different guitar tunings. So it was challenging, and you did amazing. I think you just did. I was really great.
Love it.
But you had to step up.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, I agree. Before we talk about the penultimate track on the record, let's play it. It's B-52s with Topaz. That was Topaz by B-52s. Tim Burgess here, coming to the end of this listening party for Cosmic Thing. But first, tell me about that penultimate track on the record.
Topaz.
Oh, that's an interesting one.
Yeah, that one, I had the music. Again, it was just one of those that kind of started out for myself. And then I thought, oh, well, we'll see what this does, you know. And actually, I had the first, I wrote the first lyric, I think. New cities by the sea, skyscrapers are winking.
Yeah.
Some hills are never seen, the universe is expanding. Yeah. And then you guys took it from there.
Well, we didn't have a title.
No, we didn't. So I was commuting back and forth from Woodstock, which was about a two-hour drive into the city. So I was doing that 4 or 5 days a week. How many days did we rehearse? Like four or five days a week, maybe?
I think four days a week, I think.
God, that's so good.
Maybe five, yeah.
For, yeah. Anyway, so I would use that time. I would listen to the jams and the cassette. I put it in the car, cassette player, and I would listen. And we had been working on that song. So I was listening to the jams, and Cindy and Kate had this wonderful melody that they sang, but there was no lyric. It was just like,
Topaz.
Yeah. And so right at that moment, I was listening to that part, and I was passing a billboard sign for advertising a car called Topaz. And I went, Topaz, I like that word. So, it was like, so I suggested, why don't you say Topaz here?
Oh, but don't forget, Elaine, the psychic, said we needed two more songs. She said, we need two more songs, Elaine Ault. And she said, just consulted with her. And I said, oh, the album's going great. And she said, you need two more songs. I don't consult psychics. She's the only one I've ever consulted. And it was only rare. But I did ask her. And she said, I have two words. One is Topaz and one is Footprints. And I thought, what the hell? What could that mean? And then Keith saw that sign. And she said Topaz. And it was like, oh my God, Keith said, that's the name of the city. I didn't even connect it.
Wow.
He said, that should be the name of the city. And then the footprints, I interpret it to be Rome, because we hadn't done that yet. So anyway, thought that was,
wow.
Yeah.
Or follow your bliss.
Follow your bliss.
Yes. Yeah. Could be. Yes.
Could be that too.
Which is the next one.
Yeah.
I think it's good to consult psychics. Yeah.
She was right on. She was very positive. She was never one to say, yeah, like, oh, you know, she's always like, yeah, upbeat.
You could say the whole album is footprints.
Yes, you could.
Because it's kind of tracing our story. Yeah. I mean, I feel like the album, the whole album is pretty autobiographical, really.
Yeah, for sure. So, follow your bliss.
Yeah, follow your bliss. That one was one I just did for myself. I always, I'm a big fan of Duane Eddy.
Yeah.
And guitar. Yeah. And I just kind of, I want to try to do something like that. So I was just inspired, you know, to do something with it. So the melody line is a guitar part. So I just did that for myself. And then I played it for you guys and Fred, Katie, and Cindy. And they were like, let's put it in the album, I guess.
Beautiful.
So there it goes.
And what about the title?
Well, the title comes from Joseph Campbell.
Nice.
And it was one of his phrases.
Yeah.
Follow your bliss.
I believe that.
Which is what we did.
Yeah.
Which is what we've done.
Exactly. Yeah, I just thought that's beautiful ending to it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the sound of the album, really. It's very blissful.
Yeah, it's a great ending to the album.
The closure. Yeah, it's sort of like the closing theme to a movie, you know.
Yeah.
The credits.
Yeah, the credits.
Exactly.
Well, thank you very much for your time and giving us a wonderful insight to this incredible album.
Thank you.
It's been fun.
Thank you for listening.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't thank you enough. What a band.
Thank you.
That's Follow Your Bliss, concluding the listening party on Absolute Radio. Thank you to Kate Pearson and Keith Strickland for taking me through the B-52's album Cosmic Thing. Every listening party, I like to recommend a few records that I've been listening to this past week. So the first recommendation is Pink Pantheress, and the song's called Pain from the album To Hell With It. I'm also going to recommend Time Between from the album Younger Than Yesterday by The Birds. Definitely top five bands of all time for me, but occasionally number one. So let's say that today The Birds are my favourite band. I would like to recommend Carole King, Tapestry. I'm sure I've probably recommended it before, but this song's You've Got a Friend. I'm going to recommend Soldier of the Heart by Judy Sill, and that's on the album Heart Food. Check out the documentary. Very special artist from, I'm going to say, the 70s. She was part of the Laurel Canyon scene, produced quite a big single called Jesus was a Crossmaker, and that was produced by Graham Nash from The Hollies and also Crosby, Stills and Nash. Replay any past episodes of my listening party by searching and following Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts. There you'll be able to catch up on every episode of the series, from The Libertines to ABC to Travis. We may be at the end of the show, but keep tweeting me your thoughts using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party. Every song was taken from the B-52's Cosmic Thing. All tracks are written by the B-52's except Rome, with lyrics by Robert Waldrop. The album was released on Reprise in June 1989. I'm Tim Burgess, and thanks for listening. I'll see you soon for another listening party.
Absolute Radio, telling the story behind another iconic album with Tim Burgess.
Get involved using the hashtag Tim's Twitter Listening Party.